Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. President Bush has added his voice to those warning that New Orleans is still not safe as it rebuilds from Hurricane Katrina. Residents began entering the Algiers section of the city today as part of Mayor Ray Nagin's plan to reopen New Orleans one zip code at a time. President Bush publicly questioned that plan today, citing things such as the lack of clean water, health and emergency services, and the latest forecast warnings that Tropical Storm Rita could become a hurricane and hit the Gulf Coast.
If it were to rain a lot, there is concern from the Army Corps of Engineers that the levees might break. And so, therefore, we're cautious about encouraging people to return at this moment of history.
Joining us on the line from New Orleans is Reuters correspondent Matt Daly. And Matt, the president says he has concerns about reopening the city. What is the situation like right now?
Well, the city is still very much a disaster area. Basic services are not available in the majority of the area. Water supplies or clean water is not available for the residents. The electricity service is only up in very few areas. And first responders, that is police and fire crews, are not easily accessible. There are some numbers that have been provided, but for people coming in, they're going to be mostly on their own.
Mm-hmm. And what about safety?
Safety remains a big concern as people come in. There are a lot of trees down still. There are power lines hanging around, although work proceeds virtually around the clock on that. But as people try to clear the debris from their homes and their yards, health officials are very worried that they'll see a jump in the number of injuries, accidents that may really put a great deal of pressure on the healthcare services here.
And people are being warned that if they do return, they're doing so at their own risk.
Exactly. There's a flyer that the people at the checkpoints into the city are handing out to residents returning, warning them that they are coming in at their own risk, that they need to bring food, they need to bring water. Many of those supplies are available through the emergency services here, but they're basically coming into to a disaster zone, and they'll have to really be careful as they come in. And if more people come in, obviously there'll be health problems, injuries will overload the hospitals. That remains on everyone's mind.
Can the federal government say no to Louisiana officials or to New Orleans officials? You can't bring these people back yet?
Well, the federal officials here on the ground are stressing that the final decision is really Mayor Nagin's. And they're going out of their way a little bit here on the ground to say that this is a discussion, it's going to be a consultation, that these decisions will not be made quickly. But I think towards the end of the day, we'll have a much better idea about how the phased reopening will go.
Some business owners returned over the weekend. What was their experiences? What were they like?
Most of them were anxious to get back. They've been out of the city for 3 weeks now. They really were coming back in large part to see the damage to their buildings. They wanted to see if there had been any looting. People that I ran into in the Central Business District downtown really just wanted to assess the damage. For many of these business owners, it doesn't make economic sense for them to come back right now. Their customers aren't here. Those outside the restaurant industry or outside the few bars that have owners, the few bars that have opened up in the French Quarter, they won't have anyone coming in their doors. And they don't know where their employees are in many cases. Those people are scattered across the Gulf Coast.
And how is the city regulating those who come into the areas that are being allowed to open?
Well, Mayor Nagin has welcomed back business owners to the downtown area in the French Quarter over the weekend. There were not large numbers of people coming in. And they were bringing generators. If they were a restaurant owner, they would try to bring some supplies so they could at least get some very basic operations running. The city, for the most part, is too busy really taking care of the disaster still to have much interaction with them once they get into the city.
We are still in hurricane season here, and obviously today we're hearing news that the Tropical Storm Rita may actually come close to the same area where we're trying to still rebuild from the Katrina devastation. Is there concern among folks there about future storms?
Certainly. Everyone in the city knows that there's a storm out in the Gulf, whether it's expected to come into the Gulf. Everyone is looking at the models where they can get information to see where that storm is headed. Federal officials have been quite blunt in their warnings. The levee system here remains compromised. They've patched the breaches, but there is a great fear that any rising waters might topple those levees again and send water back into many of the neighborhoods that are still devastated.
All right, Matt, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Matt Daly is a Reuters correspondent. He spoke to us from New Orleans. In Afghanistan, voters have gone to the polls for the country's first legislative elections in more than 30 years. Turnout from Sunday's elections was lower than expected, with only 50% of the country's 12 million registered voters projected to have cast ballots. The voting was plagued by scattered violence and confusion about the more than 5,000 candidates on the ballot, many of whom were former warlords. Scott Baldoff is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor who's covering the election. He's on the line with us from Kabul. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
My pleasure.
The results of Sunday's balloting won't be known for months, but what do you make of the turnout? We're hearing right now that it was about 20% lower than the presidential election last October. Was it because of the violence that had been happening or confusion or dissatisfaction with candidates? What was it that kept people away?
It could be a combination of all of those factors, and really we don't know what the motives are for people to have stayed home. What we can say is that anecdotally, we reporters were able to see fewer voters lined up at the polls, certainly in Kabul. This was also seen to be true in other cities around the country. All we ended up doing was talking to people who did vote, and many of those folks were very hopeful about what was going to come out of the parliament. But later, as we started to find people who didn't have their fingers stained with ink, the permanent ink, and asked them why they didn't vote this time around, some were saying that, look, we're seeing the same cast of characters that helped ruin this country in the last 23 years or so. Why should we vote for them? How can we believe in this process?
Because former...
Also, we're just confused about that ballot. And remember, in Kabul, which had the largest number of candidates, there were 390 people to choose from. Their faces were smaller than a postage stamp. It was very difficult for many voters. The vast majority of Afghans don't know how to read. To be able to choose the person that they really thought would make a good leader.
What about the rules about who could run? You mentioned that there was some dissatisfaction among voters who said that it was the same people on the ballot who had been in power before. Were there Taliban fighters on the ballots as well?
There were. There were some. There were four Taliban commanders or chief officials who were running. One of them was the former foreign minister under Mullah Omar, and there also was a commander, Mullah Rakati, in Zabul. All of these men are better known for their prowess on the battlefield than in politics. In addition, though, they were also commanders from the jihad times of the 1980s and then the brutal civil war of the early 90s, people who were blamed for firing rockets indiscriminately into civilian areas. And killing hundreds of thousands in Kabul alone. So there are very bad memories towards these people.
And how did they get on the ballot then?
Anyone who wanted to give their name as a candidate could get on the ballot. And then there was a period in which people had the right to raise objections. But it comes down to evidence. And the UN and the election authorities said very clearly that, look, you know, this is a country that is now going to be ruled by law, and we have to give these people a fair hearing. If we find evidence that somebody is a mass murderer, if we find somebody who simply didn't fill out the form correctly, we will cast them off the ballot. And 46 people were cast off the ballot. Interestingly enough, those were mostly on technical violations rather than people who were clearly implicated or proved to be warlords.
Do ordinary Afghans view these elections as a step toward democracy or basically a formality? What would you say, Scott?
Well, they're still not all that sure what democracy is. Remember, for many Afghans, the word democracy is associated with the Soviet regime that controlled here, much in the way that the East Germans had the name democracy associated with their republic. So there are bad memories from that word democracy and a lot of misperceptions as to what it really means. Many people just see this as an opportunity to choose their leaders, which is ultimately what democracy is supposed to be about. And so, you know, for that half of the registered voters who may have shown up to vote yesterday, they would have had a good feeling that this is the first time that they really could choose their leadership and get their voices heard, something they still don't feel is happening under the presidency of Mr. Karzai.
Scott Baldoff is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's in Kabul, Afghanistan, where he's covering that country's first parliamentary elections in 35 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're now joined by two guests. Nemat Najumi fought with the Afghan resistance against Soviet forces in his home country. He became a peace activist and is now a senior fellow at the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University in Virginia. Andrew Reynolds is a political scientist who's been working with a leading NGO in Afghanistan as an election advisor. He's an associate professor at the University of North Carolina, and he joins us from his office. Nemat, let's start with you. Were you surprised that the turnout was lower than expected?
Not really. This is something that among a number of scholars, myself, has forecasted in the past. Because of the ground reality, there are two scenarios in Afghanistan. One, what the leadership in Afghanistan and here in the United States wish for Afghans, and the other side is that what is the reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground dictates the outcome of any sort of events like election. And in the last 4 years, especially after the presidential election in Afghanistan, people were very excited. They were waiting and were looking at the presidential election last October as a momentum that's going to turn Afghanistan into a democratic path toward sustainable social and political transformation and development, but still 80% of population living in rural areas, and the absolute majority of them are facing severe lack of reconstruction projects and variety of different shortages. In addition to all of that, the lack of personal and familiar and communal security. Still, many of them are under the physical security threat by the militias, as well as those local police who were a part of the militia in the past and now well connected mostly with Islamist groups.
Andrew, I'd like to ask you, what's your reaction to the election? There wasn't as much violence as had been possible, actually, because of the violence that had been taking place in Afghanistan recently. What do you think?
Well, certainly the lack of violence was something that was a happy surprise in one sense because of what had led up to the election day itself. And I think the administrative foundations of the elections worked a lot better this time than for the presidential elections last October. So on the positive side, you have both a more peaceful day and a smoother administrative process for the elections, and hopefully that will be continued through the counting process. I mean, the trouble is that a lot of the ball game in these elections is in the results, is in what type of parliament is produced, who are those representatives that go to Kabul and represent the regions and the cities and towns. And the difficulty with this system and this election system, which was really an accident, put in place by an accident, is that it's somewhat of a lottery about who's actually going to be elected. And so we really don't know what type of legislature is going to be produced from these elections, whether it can function, whether it'll have any form of coherence.
Okay, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll continue our conversation with Nemat Najumi, fellow at George Mason University, and Andrew Reynolds, political science professor from the University of North Carolina, after our short break. There's more coming up here and now. The voting is over in Afghanistan, and soon the ballot counting will begin. While the election was relatively peaceful, turnout was low and confusion was high over a system which put thousands of candidates, including many former warlords, on the ballot. While the results will not be known for several weeks, the process raises questions about whether elections are the best way to bring democracy to Afghanistan. Joining us to talk about this are Nemat Najumi, an Afghan who's a fellow at George Mason University, and Andrew Reynolds, a political science professor at the University of North Carolina who's been working as an election advisor in Afghanistan. Andrew, right before the break, you mentioned the problems with the process and how those problems contribute to voter confusion. How did people make up their minds about the thousands of candidates on the ballot?
Well, I think candidates were able or attempted to communicate their symbol or their photograph to voters, And what that probably did was give an advantage to the regionally strong or locally strong power brokers that are currently exist in the country. And so one of the troubling signs is that perhaps the people who were able to work the system better and communicate their image and perhaps speak to more people are the warlords, are the local power brokers that are perhaps the people that may not be the most progressive in those societies. And some of the emerging civil society groups, the women's groups, some of the more liberal democratic groups, found it much more difficult to communicate who they were on the ballot and what they were standing for.
And political affiliation was not listed, correct?
Right. And apparently only about 12% of candidates had a party political affiliation, but that wasn't listed on the ballot, so you couldn't tell if it was an old Mujahideen party or a liberal democratic party. You couldn't actually tell where this individual came from.
Neymat, earlier Scott told us that anyone who wanted to run was allowed to, and he said there were even former members of the Taliban on the ballot. Do you think that that may have kept some voters away from the polls?
Actually, yes, especially in the municipal level at the major cities where people have greater access to information and they can get great deal of information about the candidates. And there are a number of people who are well known for their activities in the militancy wars and the destruction of the country. And Scott has mentioned that a candidate, his name is Salam Rakhity. Rakhity, because his nickname, Rakhity, it is a nickname, not a last name, for instance, came from the fact that he was the one that shooting rockets. And Rakhity means a person who is a specialist in shooting rockets. So, and this gentleman now in the ballot, and he is running for the to be a candidate for the parliament. And similar scenarios one can see in a number of different areas. In the rural area especially, where districts are closed and they do not have enough communication with the cities, and especially they don't know really about what's going on in Kabul. And in addition to that, people are not aware of the regulations, the rules of the to vote and have enough information on the background of new candidates, as Andrew has mentioned, has created two sort of feelings among people. One, they were confused about new candidates. And second, those who knew from the past, they were the member of the Mujahideen groups or affiliated with warlords, and they had to go for in a closed social and political environment and vote for those people who were not happy with them. So many people just didn't want to get out. They didn't. They know that it's not going to change because they have similar experiences since the presidential election. People went massively, especially women. They took a lot of risk and went to polling stations and risked their life, but nothing really much changed since.
So wait a minute, just 1 second. Andrew, let me ask you this then, bringing up that point. This has been described, this balloting Sunday, has been described as the last formal step towards setting up a democracy in Afghanistan. Is the country ready to stand on its own?
Well, I think the rule of thumb, for me at least, working in other post-conflict situations, is that you move to elections as soon as it is possible that you can have anything approximating a free and fair campaign, that you allow people to choose their leaders at the earliest stage possible. Now, it may have come slightly too early in Afghanistan in the sense that that climate for free campaigning really doesn't exist yet, and the new types of politics haven't been able to emerge. A different non-warlord type of politics hasn't had the space to emerge as yet. But clearly, these elections are just one baby step on a much longer road to full democratization and actually rooting democracy as the main way of processing conflicts within the country. Because now, democracy will take root if the institutions have some legitimacy and people see them to be acting in the country's interests and being coherent and successful. And so now the president has to work with this legislature and pass legislation and implement changes within society. And that, I think, is going to be the real test. The trouble with the process right now is that it's incredibly fragile. And if the legislature or if the president is unable to make a visible change in people's lives, then I can see that legitimacy, that support for these institutions slipping away very quickly.
And Nemat, just briefly to you, what other institutions do you think might be needed in Afghanistan to help instill democracy there?
I do believe one of the most crucial areas is the support and the of the central government to function in a way that can provide services, basic services that have been promised to the Afghan citizens. There are massive level of corruption at the government administration, and administrative and judicial reforms are on the tap of the agenda for post-election should be by the president. In addition to that, I do agree that both presidential election and...
Sorry about that. We're going to have to cut you off. We're just about out of time. We are out of time, actually. Thanks to both of you for speaking with us. Nemat Najumi is a senior fellow at George Mason University, who is from Afghanistan. Andrew Reynolds is a political science professor at the University of North Carolina. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
It's Here and Now. Some 700 schools in Louisiana and Mississippi were closed after Hurricane Katrina, displacing an estimated 372,000 school children. Many of those students are now attending public schools in other parts of the country, but in some areas, the children are being educated at special schools that have been set up on the military bases where their families were placed following the hurricane. These special separate classrooms are raising some questions about whether they amount to educational segregation. Joining us on the line to talk about this are Dr. Carl Bankston. He's a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans, now in Naples, Florida, and he's an expert in school segregation issues.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Pamela Atkinson. She's an advocate for the homeless in Utah, and she's advisor to Utah's governor on Katrina evacuees. Pamela, hello.
Hello.
Let's ask you first, Pamela, how many evacuees are we talking about in Utah, and how many are children?
We had about 600 evacuees come over the weekend, two weekends ago, and about 90 of them were K through 12.
And what is happening in terms of their education?
I made the decision that because the children were so traumatized and at the parents' request, since we had classrooms at Camp Williams, we started doing various programming, various activities, and also assessment and evaluation of the children. We knew that it was for a very short time because many of the evacuees were going to family and friends in other states, so we knew it was only very temporary. And then the children who are going to be staying here, we've had a chance to do an assessment, an evaluation, have a plan for them. And now as they're going out into the school districts, those plans are being given to the teachers. And so there's no time being wasted. And we felt that we helped to bring a little stability to the children's life rather than bussing them off Camp Williams site.
Mm-hmm. And what's the racial makeup of the evacuees who have come to Utah?
It is probably about 90% African-American.
Mm-hmm. Many folks say it's a bad idea to put the kids in separate classrooms. With Utah being a predominantly white state, and as you said, 90% of the evacuees being African-American, do you think that there is something to it because of the image of perhaps a racial issue involved?
Well, when you say predominantly white state, we do have 1.9% blacks. We have 17% Hispanics. Several of our school districts now, the ethnic minority, have become the majority. We're not quite so white as we used to be.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bankston, let's go to you now. Louisiana and Baton Rouge most recently had its own history of segregation problems. Should the children who were evacuated be educated in separate schools or folded into public school systems?
Well, if I were in Ms. Atkinson's position, I would probably advocate exactly what she's doing. I think she has, and Utah has good reasons for wanting to educate these students separately. They are, at least as far as we know, only temporarily there, and they do also have special needs. At the same time, it is politically problematic to educate any group of students separately, especially predominantly African-American students. It also may not necessarily be in their best interest, although it certainly would be the easiest thing to do for the school system, because many of these students come from educationally and socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds. The New Orleans school system has historically been one of the lowest-rated school systems in the country. I think it may well be the case that educating them separately now, although there is a good argument for that, simply replicates the same situation that disadvantaged them educationally in their home places, and in fact was the justification for attempts to desegregate schools.
Pamela Atkinson, what would you say to that?
Well, I would say, why on earth would I take a traumatized child from his or her parent and take them, bus them off to a school where they're only going to be for one or the most 2 or 3 weeks, then go to another school after that 2 or 3 week period when they've found an apartment or a house to live? That seems to me that it's adding to the trauma. I really feel strongly that the way we've done it, each child has been assessed, and we are very much aware that many of the children that we've tested and evaluated are anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 grades below where they should be.
I'm wondering, how does the placement of the students in public school classrooms affect the No Child Left Behind Act, or even the way that test scores are reported and school accountability is determined?
Well, with so many refugees from other countries coming here, and with over 50% of our students in certain school districts now being non-white, what we're finding is that people are illiterate in their own languages. We have a huge number of special educators. We have brought in people to do mentoring and tutoring for all of those children. We've just recently got the No Child Left Behind report, and we have fewer schools that failed this year. And I think it is because of the involvement of more educators, but also the public who have been trained in how to mentor and tutor many of these children who are several grades behind. And we are actually making plans that every child who was an evacuee here, when they get into their new school with their plan, they will have one-on-one education, particularly from some of the black educators that have been helping us at Camp Williams.
Dr. Bankston, I'm wondering, perhaps separate classes are less disruptive, and keeping the families together on Camp Williams, is that a strong enough argument here?
It's a strong argument. I guess ultimately it would depend on how temporary this is. If they can fold them into the school system and completely integrate them in the long run, then it may blunt any criticisms of educating them separately in the beginning. I can't imagine that a large influx of educationally and socioeconomically disadvantaged students could have anything but a negative impact on schools and classrooms. And so there may be a real conflict of interest in terms of what's in the interest of these newly arrived students and what's in the interest of the schools themselves and the students who are already there.
Dr. Carl Bankston is a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans. He's now in Naples, Florida. Pamela Atkinson is an advocate for the homeless in Utah and advisor to Utah's governor on Katrina evacuees. Stay with us. Coming up, one woman's story of racial integration on Martha's Vineyard. You're listening to Here and Now. Today's New York Times reports that the New Orleans Museum of Art was largely untouched by Hurricane Katrina. Museum staffers and their family members worked to move precious artwork to safe locations, stockpiled water for themselves anywhere they could, and at one point refused to evacuate when floodwaters first reached the building. Eventually, rescue crews ferried them off in small boats, and security guards took over at the museum. But as we've heard on Here and Now, not everyone in the New Orleans arts community was so lucky. Myra Meir is founder and director of the Jefferson Ballet Theater in Kenner, just outside of New Orleans, and she joins us from her damaged studio. Hello, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, here I am.
Yeah, there you are.
Beautiful downtown Kenner.
What does it look like?
Oh, it's like a war zone. I mean, you know, nothing that I was prepared to see, really. You know, they have picked up a lot of the power lines and everything, but the trees are down, houses are all, you know, ruined. My ballet studio, my house, was on the water. It's been terrible.
So you evacuated from Jefferson Parish, where you live with your family and work in the studios that you own, before the storm, correct?
Yes, I did. Everything was so fast. I mean, basically just left with my videotapes for all the choreography and all the performances that I have done, so, and my pictures of the kids, and that's it.
What's the state of your studios right now?
Oh, the studio is full of mold. Hundreds of my costumes and scenery have been ruined. I try to save as much as I could. You know, I've been trying to dry the costumes outside. Thank God it's been, you know, a really good day. But, you know, a lot of stuff is ruined.
How long have you been working out of those studios?
Oh, I have the studio for 33 years.
And how is this going to affect what you have been planning to do?
Well, it's a terrible because, you know, we had the Nutcracker auditions planned like a week ago, and we had a gala coming up. I mean, a lot of, you know, different things, and now there's no students. There's, you know, no costumes. It's nothing that I was prepared to have to start all over again.
Mm-hmm. Where are your students now?
Who knows? I mean, out of over 150 students, only one has been able to get in touch with me. I don't know where they are. And that to me is the worst loss, you know, because they're like part of my family. You know, I mean, we see them every day, you know.
What happens now? Well, do you think you'll be able to even put on a performance of the Nutcracker?
Oh, no. There's no way. I mean, the studio has to be torn apart. I have a special dance floor that the water got underneath it, and it's starting to buckle a little bit. You know, it's going to be a couple of months from now, you know, whenever we can get people to work on it.
Was that your biggest production of the year?
Oh, yeah, that's our moneymaker in order to, you know, to do other performances. Nutcracker is always, you know, the very biggest performance.
When do you think you might be able to be up and running again at least?
Well, I would think, I mean, you know, to be really, like, realistic, I would think probably January. Hopefully, you know, so many things that need repair, and you know, we don't know.
You know, folks say that dancers are a fairly dedicated bunch. Do you think that anything in your training sort of helped prepare you to try to be able to deal with this?
Oh, I think so. I think that, and also my background. I'm from Cuba, and we are like very strong people, you know, and we're going to like go ahead and succeed no matter what. I mean, you know, I'm more determined now than I ever was to, you know, to do better and bigger things. I'm just ready. I just need a studio and I need students, you know, that type of thing.
Well, Myra, good luck.
Oh, thank you so much.
Myra Meir is founder and director of the Jefferson Ballet Theater in Kenner, outside New Orleans. As always, we welcome your thoughts about our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. The devastation of Hurricane Katrina has Americans now taking a hard look at their country's racial divide. Although the island of Martha's Vineyard is not usually thought of as a diverse place, it has a unique history of racial integration. Author Jill Nelson's family has been vacationing in the small town of Oak Bluff since the 1950s. Back then, they only dared to drive to their vacation home at night. Nelson writes about this in her book, Finding Martha's Vineyard, African Americans at Home on an Island. Reporter Rachel Gottbaum talked with Nelson overlooking Nantucket Sound.
We're on the porch of my house in Martha's Vineyard, the house that I share with my three siblings. It was left to us by our mother. Now we're on the porch where we spend a lot of time eating, overlooking Ocean Park and Nantucket Sound, and the place where, even though I spend a couple of months a year here, I feel most comfortable and most at home.
Tell me how long you've owned this house.
My parents bought it in 1967. We had come up here since 55 and rented different houses every summer. And we would pass this house. It used to have pink shutters and lots of pansies. And my father would always say, I love that house. That's the house I want.
You say in the book that your family was criticized by other African Americans in the community when they paid this much.
My mother's a story in the book where my mother talks about people here saying that they were driving the prices up to pay the amount of money that they paid for this house, which was $35,000. Back then, houses here went for $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. Wonderful houses that are still standing. The same people are in them, and they're now worth $800,000.
Could you talk about how this area, how the former cottage city mm-hmm. became Oak Bluffs and became a magnet for African Americans?
Oak Bluffs was completely designed as a tourist magnet. People found there were the Methodist campgrounds were drawing thousands of people a summer for religious revivals. Methodism, we think, was brought here by an African American named John Saunders, who preached here. He's a former slave. What happened was many African Americans came here to work for white families who had summer homes here, and this is the late 1800s, and found that they loved the place and they wanted a piece of the rock. So a woman would come as a laundress for a family and then realize lots of people need their laundry done. I can go back to Martha's Vineyard, rent a cottage, buy it up the road, and start my own laundry. Many, many African American entrepreneurs, especially black women, came and started guest houses where they rented rooms to people who wanted to come here on vacation. And a sort of weird factoid is that several of these guest houses owned by African Americans did not accept African Americans as guests.
In fact, you talk about in the book this woman, Martha James, who was refused a cottage rental when she came and then spawned a decree by the Methodists. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Martha rented a cottage in the campgrounds, Martha James, and when she got here was told that she wouldn't be happy here because she was a Negro. And she protested, it got in the newspaper, and the Cottage Campground Association at that time issued a decree saying that we're not going to discriminate against people based on race. This is pretty radical for the turn of the century. I think it is in many ways indicative of a spirit that thrives at its best on the vineyard. This is not to say that the vineyard is absent racism or racial tension at times, but it certainly is the best place I've been in the United States in terms of living in some harmony with a diverse group of people. And I think the island tries to struggle with issues of race when they come up.
You talk about the thrill of when you got woken up by your parents in the 50s to come on the ferry. But tell us about what you learned later about why they always traveled in darkness.
You know, for 40 years almost, I used to always come to the vineyard at that time. It was just, you go to the vineyard in the middle of the night. It wasn't until 4 decades later, really, that I came to understand through talking to my mother that they left then because of segregation, racism, not wanting to have to stop somewhere and be apprehensive about how they would be received. You know, those days are long over. You know, you go, come here whenever, I certainly drive here now whenever I want and stop wherever I'd like. But I think that there is a spirit of tolerance here. And I think the vineyard is unique because it is one of the few resorts with a really sizable African-American population that's integrated. I know all my neighbors of all colors and ages, and we all get along, you know, united by this, our love for this place.
You interviewed the Brown sisters, and they say that they're the first black family to buy in Oak Bluffs on the ocean. Could you talk a little bit about that?
They thought it was funny. Their father, Lucian Brown, was an extremely successful physician. They did economically, they were very secure in New York, so they thought it was sort of funny. And they soon thereafter were accepted in the community, and they're still there today. I think a lot of what happens at the vineyard is the nature of New England. I think New Englanders are people who in general don't want to be bothered and don't want to bother you. Many people write about the vineyard and describe the African-American people here as the black elite. And I think it's often meant negatively. Everybody I know here works, has worked for their house, is still working for it. Will there in future generations be people of color here who are here because of inherited wealth? I hope so. Why not? And I think we really need to challenge ourselves as African Americans and as Americans. Because I never hear anybody talk about the white people here as a white elite, do you know, or in the Hamptons or anywhere else. And so I think that this notion that African Americans here are somehow an elite in a negative way, snobbish, not hardworking people, disconnected from the African American community in general or communities in general, it's just really specious. And one reason I wrote the book was kind of to address that and to play with these or confront these issues of class.
How did you do that?
Well, I think by trying to give a multi-layered, multi-level textured view of the African Americans who are here.
So tell me about some of the people that you've interviewed that have made an impression on you and that you included.
There's a woman named Carrie Tankard who lives here year-round. Turns out she came here. She was living in the housing projects in Newark, New Jersey. The riots came in 67. Her neighbor stood up to grab her son, who was looking out the window, to pull him down away from the window, and her neighbor was shot in the neck and killed. Carrie Tankard's husband, George, his mother lived on the vineyard, and he told her, pack the kids up, we're moving to Martha's Vineyard. She has since raised her 6 children here, but says, I never thought this place was home, and that she still doesn't, but that it was the best possible thing to do for her children.
Do you think that the vineyard and Oak Bluffs, this kind of community, can be recreated anywhere or exists anywhere else?
You know, I wish it could, but I don't think so. I think that the fact that we're on an island, the fact that we're in New England, the fact that we're in a state that abolished slavery relatively early, Massachusetts, the fact that we have a native community here, African Americans, Jews, Christians, there's so many Brazilians, Jamaicans, people from Ireland. It's such a unique little diverse microcosm. But I'll tell you, if I could figure out how to clone it, I would. I think America would be a better place if we had more places like this. Absolutely.
Jill Nelson is author of Finding Martha's Vineyard, African Americans at Home on an Island. She spoke with reporter Rachel Gottbaum. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news.